On October 17th, 1901, the White House issued this seemingly innocuous statement. Booker T. Washington of Tuskegee, Alabama, dined with the president last evening. Yet the reaction from Southern politicians and the press was immediate and vicious. Why was this the case? Why was there such a reaction to a simple announcement of dinner? Well, for it happened that Booker T. Washington was a prominent African-American educator and activist. And the reaction to his dinner with President Theodore Roosevelt says a lot about race and racism in late 19th and early 20th century America. And that is what we're going to be looking at today on American History 2.
Hello and welcome to the delayed episode 51 of American History 2. It was delayed because my co-host was off swanning around America, having a great time going to the most glamorous presidential libraries, those of course being Jimmy Carter's, Gerald Ford's and George H.W. Bush's. Malcolm Craig, thanks for joining me. How come you get to go to all the best places?
I don't know, I'm just lucky, I guess. No, that's a rather unfair. College Station, Texas, where the George H.W. Bush Library, it was very hot, but everyone was lovely, as they always are at the presidential libraries. I think anyone who's actually conducting research into American history, particularly issues of foreign policy and domestic policy to do with presidents and their cabinets, the presidential libraries are a fantastic resource. And the archivists and historians and all the staff that work at these locations are really, really amazing people and so helpful. So I had a great time. So yeah, sorry for delaying it because of my research trip, but I had a wonderful time at these different presidential libraries. But yes, enough of me talking about my summer research trip. So this episode, we are going to be looking at the issues of race and racism in the late 19th and early 20th century in America. And to help us discuss this, we're delighted to welcome two esteemed guests to talk us through these issues, York St. John University's Stephen Robinson and University of Exeter's Miguel Hernandez. So welcome to both of you. Thank you both for coming on the show. And if you'd just like to give us a minute on yourself and your research, just to introduce yourselves to our listeners. So Stephen, if you could introduce yourself first.
All right. So I'm based at York St. John University, been here since 2015, and I'm a graduate of Southampton University. And my research really is in African-American social intellectual history, late 19th and 20th century. And I'm currently working on a book on Booker T. Washington and another one which is based on my PhD thesis on black politics in the 1880s South.
Thanks for having me on the show. My name is Miguel Hernandez. I'm based at the University of Exeter, and my research focuses primarily on the development of white supremacist and nativist organizations in the late 19th and early 20th century, specifically the 1920s Ku Klux Klan. My first book is due to come out hopefully next year with Routledge. It's called Fighting Fraternities, Ku Klux Klan and Freemasonry in 1920s America. And it really explores how the KKK develops as a fraternity and what role that particular type of organization plays in this particular group.
Perfect. So, I mean, I think you guys should work out really well as a great team in discussing race relations at the turn of the 20th century, but with one of you looking at it from a sort of African-American standpoint and the other looking at the sort of white racist standpoint and what's going on with the KKK. So I'm going to start with a nice loaded question that I'm going to put to both of you. Is it fair to say that American race relations were never and have never been worse than they were in the first 30 years of the 20th century? And I'm going to come to you first on that, Stephen.
All right, that is a loaded question. Well, certainly since slavery, it can be, I think, regarded as the worst period. The historian Rayford Logan referred to it as the nadir of American race relations. And I think it's clear really why, in terms of the restrictions placed on African Americans, the environment within which they had to work, violent, its brutality, the system of Jim Crow, the repression essentially of basic human rights on the part of African Americans. So African Americans weren't slaves in this period anymore. Clearly, you know, African Americans were protected under the Constitution. that the door was left open for them in terms of their constitutional rights, which is important really for the kind of growing black freedom struggle that we can trace back to this time as well. But that being said, this is the period of Jim Crow, and we can't get away from that fact that this is the time when this system of institutional racism was really being kind of solidified in the South.
It's very difficult to compare, you know, race relations across sort of different periods. But I mean, some of the statistics for racial violence, particularly the lynching statistics, seem to suggest that it is going down. But at the same time, you have, all these other issues emerging. So for instance, the great migration of African Americans to the urban centers of the North during this particular period, and the race riots in particular during the First World War, really seems to suggest that they may not be improving, they're shifting and they're changing and they're evolving in different sort of ways. And beyond African Americans, the race relations issue is expanding to include Chinese Americans, and the rise of the new immigrant, you know, these people from Southern and Eastern Europe, are increasingly coming into these discussions and issues that surround the idea of race relations. So it's a complicated question to sort of say they're at their worst. They're certainly, perhaps you can say they're not improving, but particularly when compared to Reconstruction, I would probably put that as one of the particular moments where the race relations are at their lowest point, really.
And so it's interesting you mention the era of Reconstruction, the decade or so after the American Civil War. I'd be interested in hearing from both of you, as America moves into the 20th century, how did the legacies of post-Civil War Reconstruction affect and influence matters? Because, you know, it's often, for Eric Foner, I think, famously referred to it as, you know, America's unfinished revolution. So how much of a role did these failures and the outcomes of Reconstruction help to shape the racial environment of the United States moving into the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
It's there all along. I mean, it's central to the kind of political discourse, really. Certainly, by, you know, the sort of 1880s, 90s, the kind of, for white Southerners, the spectre, if you like, of Reconstruction, something not to be repeated, is there. In other words, you know, we cannot get back to that period. We have to do all we can to stop that happening again. And a good example of this is during the presidency of Benjamin Harrison, when there are efforts to try and oversee elections in the South, the Lodge Bill, which white Southerners, white Democrats vehemently oppose because they see this as kind of smacking of Reconstruction all over again. Certainly for African Americans, the Democratic legacy of Reconstruction is something that they fiercely defend, not least in the sort of continuation in limited form of black political participation after Reconstruction. And certainly it informs the growing sort of, if you like, civil rights movement of the early 20th century with the NAACP, the Niagara Movement, and all that W.E.B. Du Bois really articulates, you know, the positive legacy of Reconstruction. So you've got two different kind of memories, I think, of Reconstruction here, a kind of black memory that's much more positive of what was achieved and what is possible in America and what needed to be defended. And then you have this kind of white memory of it being this kind of tragic era of irresponsible government and something never to be repeated again.
Just to sort of add to that, I mean, the situation Reconstruction is fundamental, I would sort of say, to the race relations that follow in the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, just to quote from the Black Reconstruction in America, W.E.B. Du Bois' classic text on this particular sort of era. I mean, the very famous quote that says, "The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, and then moved back again towards slavery." And Stephen has really alluded to one of the key issues here, that it is something that for the African American community, it's absolutely fundamental, and it will create a lot of the legislation and institutions that will help them regain their rights in the 1930s and the 1940s and 1950s, such as the three Reconstruction Amendments are particularly important. But it's also, of course, a period in which the idea of white supremacy is reinvigorated, you know, to extreme levels with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. And it's also a period in which some of the key provisions of those three Reconstruction Amendments are completely and essentially obliterated. In particular, with such cases as the you know, the slaughterhouse cases in 1876, or United States v. Quickshank in 1873, Quickshank is 1876. Both of these essentially return the enforcement of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause down to the states, which essentially sets up Jim Crow and allows southern states to essentially organize whatever they want in terms of the way African Americans have to live their lives.
Great. There's a couple of things I just wanted to pick up on what you sort of both said there. And first of all is to say it's great that by episode 51, Benjamin Harrison has had his first shout out on the podcast.
That's the one and only.
Most likely.
The second best president.
And secondly, we're sort of talking a lot about, when you're talking about Reconstruction, the Civil War and everything, you're talking about the South in terms of African Americans. I want to push a wee bit more in terms of a whole holistic picture of North and South and race relations, and how much is, by the time we get to the turn of the 20th century, you know, I remember doing some research for a piece I was writing on Lincoln's centenary and his centennial, and how it's actually, apart from in some really resentful pockets of the South, it's sort of celebrated by the whole country, and this is in 1906 or 1907, I think, round about then. And also when the NAACP is formed. And I was wondering how, by this point, you've sort of got the nation has bought into the whole sort of lost cause, you know, the sort of noble South fighting for its self-rights, and how much that allows sort of white people in both the North and South to unite, and the effect that has on race relations.
I think that is a kind of critical element of what we're talking about, really. This kind of capitulation on the part, and I think that's perhaps the word to use, really, on the part of Northern whites to Southern ideas about race relations. And, I mean, you mentioned the Lost Cause, which is a good example, really, of a kind of Civil War memory, a particular form of Civil War memory that was being challenged, of course, by African Americans. Frederick Douglass, of course, famously trying to maintain, if you like, the emancipationary kind of idea of what the Civil War was about. So certainly I think there is that element. And of course, with the fact that for white Southerners, you know, the fact that they were able to be able to pass laws to, you know, segregate, to disenfranchise African American voters, was in large part because by, you know, the early 20th century, they knew that there would not be any kind of meaningful opposition from the North, any kind of forceful action taken against them. So they had a kind of free rein, really, to do what they wanted in that sense. But I think, too, there is and Miguel may want to talk more about this, about the sort of pseudoscience, you know, an Anglo-Saxon superiority that was really embraced by, you know, whites North and South.
Miguel, I was going to come to you to ask how different is the treatment of Black Americans to anyone that's a non-WASP, you know, a white non-white Anglo-Saxon Protestant at this time?
Well, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing because in order to create this system of Jim Crow and this system of segregation, you have to create the idea of whiteness. You have to construct what it means to be white. And it's something that in the U.S. has a very particular sort of meaning. It's, you know, it's the one drop kind of rule. Whereas, for instance, in South Africa, in the apartheid system, to determine whether you're black, they'd have a very peculiar system of essentially putting a pencil in your hair, and if it stayed there because of the curly hair, you would be considered black. But in the U.S., it's a very different sort of picture. As a great example of this, Homer Plessy, from the very famous Plessy v. Ferguson case, during the test where he has to sort of get on the train in Louisiana and actually travel in first class, he actually has to declare to the ticket inspector that he is in fact black, because he is only 1/8 black and he looks white. So in order to force that, he has to actually announce that he is part black. So the construction of whiteness is fundamental to this particular issue. But by the 1880s and 1890s in particular, as the new immigrants start arriving as people from Southern and Eastern European, Austro-Hungary, the Russian Empire, and places like that, the idea of whiteness starts to shift a little bit, and the creation of these racial hierarchies starts to become more solidified in both scientific texts, but also in public rhetoric, as people start to encounter different kinds of white people and different people that they just do not recognize as being similar to them. Now, I don't want to give the indication that the Italians are being treated as bad as African Americans, but they are being treated in similar terms, in terms of stereotypes, in terms of being forced into certain neighborhoods. But of course, since most of these immigrants are arriving into the northern and urban industrial sections, these sort of restrictions on their lives are primarily de facto discrimination rather than the de jure discrimination that exists primarily in the South in terms of African Americans. So it's a little more informal, but it affects their lives in similar ways. But, it's certainly worse for African Americans.
So, Miguel, you conveniently mentioned there the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision, the ruling that endorses the idea of separate but equal in the eyes of the Supreme Court. But, Stephen, I mean, you've written there's been perhaps too much focus on Plessy versus Ferguson at the expense of a number of cases that were lodged prior to that in the 1880s. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how these cases in the 1880s have been neglected and why it's important for our understanding of racism at the time to look at these particular cases.
Sure. Well, it's understandable why I think Plessy has been studied a lot and why it's seen as that kind of turning point, because obviously what happened in 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education, which overturns that decision. But in large part is because in very much the sort of historical debate, and C. Van Woodward is arguably the most famous historian here, really is trying to understand, well, what is going on in the 1890s and why is it that segregation laws, de jure segregation, begins to emerge at this particular time. And so in a way, the Plessy case seems as a kind of a convenient sort of moment to kind of explore some of these things. But I think one of the results of that, the consequences of just focusing on Plessy, is that we tend to kind of perhaps read backwards and not see what actually happens from Reconstruction onwards. And that's really the kind of perspective I've looked at. And there were a series of cases sort of grouped together in 1883, known as the Civil Rights Cases, that together the court declared unconstitutional part of the 1875 Civil Rights Act, which prohibited segregation on things like, public transportation, public accommodations. It was a relatively weak law, partly to sort of get it through Congress at that time, and was never really properly enforced. And the onus was always on African Americans to actually fund the cases themselves. So it was a sense that actually the law wasn't working, but it was there, and it was an important kind of final sort of piece, if you like, of the Reconstruction civil rights legislation. So what's important, I think, to think about when looking at the 1883 decision is how it was responded to. How did African Americans respond? And so much of my research has looked at how the 1883 decision really does start and sort of deepen, if you like, a debate about the very meaning of civil rights in America that's held not just in kind of the national press, but also at the local level. African Americans are debating this. They protest this decision. Frederick Douglass famously speaks at a meeting in Washington, D.C., where he sees this, that historians will kind of look to this moment as a clear kind of turning point in American history. You know, that things, a retrograde step was taken with this 1883 decision. So compare that with the Plessy case, which, relatively speaking, did not receive the same kind of response from African Americans, in large part because it was a kind of fait accompli by the mid-1890s. So by looking at this whole period from the Reconstruction era kind of forward, if you like, you begin to see, therefore, the kind of continuity in black politics, that African Americans were active in a variety of ways in local politics, and it did vary across the South. But I think what's important is to kind of think, well, that African-American protest did not simply stop with Reconstruction, and it didn't just sort of begin again in the early 20th century. That what we're talking about here in the early 20th century is a particular kind of phase in a much longer story of black protest. And I suppose a good example to see of how African-Americans are protesting the kind of growing calls, if you like, for segregation is Ida B. Wells and her famous incident in 1883, where she very visibly protests somebody trying to remove her from a railroad car. And that sort of marks the beginning of her own kind of activist career in the 1890s and onwards.
But just to add to that, I mean, I think it's very interesting that in the years following the Plessy v. Ferguson case and the segregation of public transport in particular, that African Americans, particularly in the urban centers, do not take this decision lying down. And in a number of cases, they institute the very same sort of boycotts that will become famous in the 50s to try and sort of prevent these things and sort of cripple these groups economically. In some cases, and I believe it's in Nashville, Tennessee, they even form a separate bus company with electric buses that is profitable for some time, but which eventually fails because the technology is not entirely sort of there. I mean, these protests essentially fail because the middle classes and the community itself is not financially stable enough to uphold a long sort of boycott. But they will use the same exact tactics further on in the future, which really sort of paints a picture of the civil rights era as being much longer than you know, than popular sort of understandings would really give it.
So if we move on now to talk about, you know, a very important African-American figure at this time, and the man that Stephen proposed that we really discuss on this podcast, and that's Booker T. Washington. And I'd like to put a sort of question to you both about two different questions. And obviously we started this podcast with the opening vignette where we talked about the visit that Booker T. Washington pays to the White House, has dinner with Teddy Roosevelt at Roosevelt's asking, and then there's a huge white backlash to it. And first of all, to come to you, Stephen, you know, who was Booker T. Washington, and why is he significant? Why do you want to write a book about him? And to Miguel, how did white people interpret Booker T. Washington? Why was there such an intense backlash to that visit?
Well, I suppose for Booker T. Washington, a study of his life, his career, I think enables us to really think through quite a fundamental question about how were African Americans to actually respond to this environment that was getting worse. And I think that's, I think to start with, we have to kind of remember that the race relations, it wasn't just that this is a moment where it's kind of static, it did change over time, but it was progressively getting worse over the course even of Washington's career from the 1880s to his death in 1915. He is the most prominent African-American of this era. He is a prominent black educator, race leader, and he does become somewhat of a black celebrity, really, internationally. But he's remembered, really, for the bargain that he makes with white Southerners. And this is in 1895, in an address in Atlanta that subsequently has been termed the Atlanta Compromise. And this compromise, this bargain that he basically states to a predominantly white audience, although African Americans were present there as well, is that he essentially said that as we African Americans, we won't agitate for civil and political rights, for social equality, which was the kind of term used at the time, if you whites allow us and give us the opportunity to make progress in education and economic progress as well, that we can build our own livelihood, that we can gain independence economically. And that was fundamentally, if I suppose, one thing that Washington really was arguing was this, in his mind, the need for African Americans to move from economic dependency on whites to economic independence, so separate from whites, that they build their own kind of economic institutions, become landowners, and that kind of thing. Now, there's a lot of questions here in terms of, was this, you know, the best solution of the time? Was it deeply flawed? And of course, it did assume that whites would stand by their side of the bargain. And of course, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that simply did not happen. So in a way, I suppose, Washington was optimistic and arguably over-optimistic about how far and how much and how far white Americans were prepared to change their views towards African Americans. And this challenge, I think, to white stereotyping alongside the kind of economic side is really fundamental to understanding Booker T. Washington, to very much in terms of his own life, Up From Slavery, which was the title of his famous 1901 autobiography, through his own life, but also visibly through his various speeches throughout the country, his use of photography, which is a whole other kind of story, is to actually challenge white stereotypes of African Americans at this time, which in of itself was a kind of legacy of slavery, and to really force whites to acknowledge African Americans as fellow citizens. Now, how that would all play out, of course, you know, there were different approaches there. But I, as I said, I think understanding kind of what he was trying to do really does help us understand the quandary that African Americans faced at the turn of the 20th century about just how to respond to this worsening environment.
From the white perspective, Booker T. Washington is playing a very important role in terms of race relations and very much as the leader of the race. So for the white population, he is very much the embodiment of Black America in some senses. And Booker T. Washington, through his sort of rhetoric, and particularly through his Atlanta Compromise speech, manages to ingratiate himself to some extent to a lot of white Americans, and he moves in a lot of he moves in social circles that help him get to the dinner. I mean, for instance, Andrew Carnegie, the great industrialist, is a big fan of his and gives him a lot of money to fund various different projects. So Booker T. Washington has a public face where he is trying to essentially, help Africa, have good relations with whites and develop this sort of rapport with them. But it should also be remembered that in private, he did a lot of things that were far more radical that he simply did anonymously. Now, in terms of how white America reacted to the dinner itself, well, it's a very complicated question because it varies according to what section of the country you're in and some of your political leanings and a variety of other sorts of issues. But in general, it's not exactly seen as, you know, as a great sort of thing, which is why, there aren't that many others invited during TR's tenure.
So one thing we should mention in the context of Booker T. Washington is obviously the famous rivalry he has with one of the other great figures of African-American activism and intellectual life, W.E.B. Du Bois, at the time. Because, you know, Du Bois contests, you know, Booker T. Washington's vision of how African Americans should behave and exist within this racist society. And it seems that his rivalry with Du Bois has shaped a historical reputation that perhaps doesn't portray Booker T. Washington in the best light? Would either of you like to comment upon this rivalry and the way in which we see Booker T. Washington through the lens of W.E.B. Du Bois?
I mean, I think the rivalry, to some extent, I think is overplayed. Certainly in terms of the views on education, the famous kind of aspect, if you like, of the rivalry, or the one that people often point to, is the fact that Booker T. Washington was a proponent of industrial education, which is a very complex kind of mix of approaches to education in terms of the actual education, but also kind of theories behind the purpose of education. But essentially, he was for foregrounding practical education, as opposed to Du Bois, who was argued that there needs to be a talented tenth of African Americans to lead the race, and as he saw it, and so higher education was a fundamental part of that. Now, neither side and neither man disagreed with the need for the other type of education. It was all where they kind of laid the stress, really. The biggest divide, between the two was this whole question of agitation for civil and political rights. And Du Bois, famously in his 1903 book, The Souls of Black Folk, there's a chapter in there of Mr. Booker T. Washington and others, where he outlines, if you like, the rise of Booker T. Washington, and argues essentially that Washington had contributed really to this assumption that African Americans did not want to have equal civil and political rights, that they weren't kind of actively pushing for this. And actually what Washington was doing was fundamentally detrimental to African Americans. So, as Miguel said, that doesn't necessarily take into account, of course, what Washington was doing privately, and the various cases of segregation cases he fought. There's also voting rights as well, other cases where he privately funds legal cases, often through intermediaries, so his name wouldn't actually be mentioned anywhere, and he was very clear in how that kind of operated. So the result of that being is that most African Americans had no idea what Washington was doing behind the scenes, even some people who thought they knew a lot about him. The other aspect of Washington, where there was a kind of divide, was how he handled the press and his squashing of opposition to his kind of vision. And this was known about, and actually what Du Bois sort of said in public was vindicated subsequently in the private correspondence of Booker T. Washington, where he did very much control the terms of the debate in terms of this is what African Americans think. And really for Du Bois, that really was the thing that really, I think, struck him the most, that no, you do not speak for me. And so in a way, that was perhaps the most, that was the most intense part, perhaps, of that kind of rivalry between the two. But certainly he does shape the kind of the view of Washington. And the Atlanta Compromise speech of 1895 is a term that Du Bois himself first used, and historians have subsequently taken that on board.
And I'd also like to turn for a moment to other African-American activists, because we've talked about two prominent male African-American activists, and we've already mentioned one of the most prominent female activists of the time, Ida B. Wells. And I've used in teaching her January 1900 speech in Chicago, I think it was, Lynch Law in America. Miguel, turning to you, what was Wells's critique of lynching, and how did it, you know, she go about making this very powerful critique of what was happening?
First, I think we should highlight, you know, how central she is within the African American struggle during this particular period. But I mean, Ida B. Wells, what's so powerful about Lynch Law in America is that it is so direct and clear about exposing the myth of lynch laws in a very clear and direct ways. repeatedly contrasting and challenging the idea that African American men are animalistic and sexually sort of voracious, and that they are at odds with white ideas of civilization and manhood, that they, she simply goes through number of different cases where she just explicitly just states the facts. And that's really where the power of her work really comes from. And you know, it's indicative that, you know, she was basically never allowed to return to her hometown, because she was talking about taboo topics. She was talking about the fact that, interracial relationships were accepted, you know, in some instances, there were people that were having interracial relationships more regularly than you might imagine, and that not all of the lynching cases were down to rape and sexual assault, which was usually invoked as the key reason for these.
So, again, Miguel, we've talked about the background to racism in America and African American activism, and you know, Stephen's very kind of, you know, clearly talked about the currents within activism and thinking about race and racism and the position of African Americans within American society. So the white reaction to all of this, in particular the KKK, I'm sure every single person listening to this has an idea of who or what the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK, where they came from, but could you just give us a brief catch-up on how they originate and what happens to the organization in the years before it's reborn in the 1910s?
Well, I mean, of course, the Klan is a very complicated subject, but just to give you sort of a brief overview of what's happened since Reconstruction, essentially, the idea of the Klan has emerged as a part of the Lost Cause mythology. In the sense that, as Reconstruction sort of ends, the Klan goes from being regarded as a terrorist organization, as an extremely violent organization, to being a defensive, and chivalrous order. Now, this is due in large part to the way the Klan sort of behaves. These ridiculous outfits, and some of the, you know, more fantastical elements, you know, in terms of fantasy, not in terms of great. Some of the fantastical elements of the Klan lead to this sort of skepticism about the fact the Klan even does these sorts of things. There's a great article by Elaine France Parsons on this particular sort of subject. Now, this particular issue leads to the recreation of the Klan as a defensive organization, which receives its first real vindication with Thomas Dixon's novel, The Leopard Spots, which comes out in 1902. This book is an absolute bestseller. And it's absolutely god-awful in terms of prose and characters and all that. But that's besides the point. The story essentially idealizes the Klan, and puts them up on a pedestal. And because of the popularity of the book, it becomes a very standard, sort of interpretation of the Klan itself. This book is actually followed by a number of academic studies by, former members of, actual members of the Dunning School of Thought, particularly Walter Fleming, who releases a new account and republishes the original prescript, the Constitution of the Klan, and they sort of pretend that this group is really a group of honorable knights that develops as a natural reaction to the problems in race relations in Reconstruction America.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I find fascinating, you know, coming out of one of Thomas Dick's novels, I think it's The Klansman, gets turned into a film, Birth of a Nation, which, if I remember correctly, is released 1915. When you read a lot of books about this time, about why the Klan resurfaces, this movie plays such a huge role. It's, you know, it's people from across America go to the cinema, see this film, which essentially portrays the Ku Klux Klan as the good guys who ride to the rescue of a femme fatale who's, you know, at the clutches of a mulatto governor in the South, basically an African-American's running wild. And so try and put this to both of you. To Miguel, how important actually is that film in reviving the Ku Klux Klan, or is that a bit of mythology? And also, Stephen, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how African-Americans really push back on Birth of a Nation. and, you know, really try and get it banned in a lot of cinemas. I think it's one of the NAACP's biggest fights, you know, in their early years, is to try and stop that film. So I'll go to Miguel first.
I don't think it's an over-exaggeration to say that without Birth of a Nation, I don't think the second plan would have been refounded. The founder of the second clan, William Joseph Simmons, you know, sort of claims that the idea for coming for refounding the clan comes to him in some sort of an apparition, as clansmen float silently across the moon in a dream that he had, which is complete crap. Because the fact of the matter is, he's trying to capitalize on the success of that film. And when the film is first shown in Atlanta, William Joseph Simmons is there with Klansmen to say, you know, as they come out, join our particular order. The film itself is from a technical perspective, absolutely revolutionary. It's very difficult to get an impression of how, you know, amazing it is because of the films that we have nowadays. But when I show the film to my students, I show them a film, you know, comparable film from the same period, and they start to understand it. David Wark Griffiths is a fantastic sort of filmmaker, in the sense that he creates a lot of the technical innovations that we now recognize as standards. So, for instance, he studied the works of the great masters of art to sort of see how they framed a particular picture and changed a whole bunch of other things. The result is a film that is incredible for its time, not only because of how long it is, but also the subject matter itself, that has people fainting in the cinema. It has people shooting at the screen when Lillian Gish is in danger. It's something that is, you know, it's fundamental to the formation of the clan. And it's really sort of suggested by its run, by, you know, how long it runs in the cinema. It's still being shown 10, 15 years after it was originally aired in the 1930s still.
Yeah, I mean, understandably, very negatively, and as you suggested earlier, I mean, there were attempts to ban this Boston famous example of trying to ban this film, because essentially it goes back to that point about the stereotyping of African Americans. And this is something that is recognized, you know, through film as powerful. And it's not just a sense that whites are going to be, you know, reading about this in novel form or in newspapers, but, you know, cinema is becoming incredibly popular. And so you have a wide spread, or, you know, a large cross-section of American society that will watch this film. And of course, added to that, it's screened at the White House. And, you know, Wilson famously sort of says, you know, look, this is history on the screen. And so, there, as I said, there are efforts to ban it. Booker T. Washington, this is towards the end of his life, he gets involved with this. And in fact, there is talk, this never happens, of actually making a film on Booker T. Washington's life as to sort of counteract the message of Birth of a Nation in terms of African Americans and their place in American society. But the other thing too, I think, to remember from the impact of this film, and touching on a point earlier, is that here is a film that is presenting a very clear interpretation of the Reconstruction era. And so this film, along with, you know, Dixon's novels, along with the sort of historical interpretations of the time, is really reinforcing this negative portrait that we mentioned earlier of Reconstruction, that is becoming a mainstream view by the 19-teens and 20s.
I mean, the film itself takes that role very, very seriously. And throughout the film, you will see excerpts from, for instance, Woodrow Wilson's History of the American Peoples thrown in there to sort of back up this idea that this is a historical film. There are these various vignettes and facsimiles of historical moments that are meant to reinforce it. And the NAACP pushes back on this very, very strongly. And the film itself has to go through some small changes to adapt to that. But just to give you an idea of how the African-American community sort of portrays it, Walter White, one of the future directors of the NAACP, in a letter to the Censors Board of Columbus, Ohio, wrote that by idealizing the Ku Klux Klan, which is the spirit of lynching organized, and by painting the Negro as a vicious, lustful brute, the birth of the nation has done irreparable harm. And that really sort of implies how powerful the film is, because it's pretending to be documentary. It's pretending to be, as Woodrow Wilson said, history with lightning.
Yeah, I could do a series of podcasts on just how much I dislike Woodrow Wilson. So, you know, if you guys ever want to come back and just do like a Wilson bashing one, my entire goal as a historian, even though it's not my era, is just to destroy his historical reputation. Anyway, and the other thing that was interesting, saying you said that there was, Stephen, you said there was a suggestion that they were going to make a film about Booker T. Washington, because obviously D.W. Dreyfus does go on to make a sort of apologetic film called Intolerance, which is, you know, sort of flips, but is absolutely bombs in comparison to the Birth of a Nation. It's not the message Americans want to hear at the time. And but sort of move this chat on and refocus again on the KKK. But the one thing I was really struck when I sort of teach the KKK in this era is just how much it's all about Americanism. And who, and I mean, I don't want to make this crude portrayal because it really isn't, you know, the exact same, but it is very much the sort of America first rhetoric and who are Americans, or as Sacha Baron Cohen said, who is America? Like, why do you think they take what's going on with race relations and all the sort of the anti-Irish and anti-Italian things you were talking about earlier and make the KKK based on Americanism?
I think the influence of the First World War in particular is fundamental to this particular issue. The hyper-patriotism of the home front, formation of groups like the American Protective League and its children's version, the Anti-Yellow Dog League, creates this situation where militant ideas of what it means to be American, with no regards to nationality, with no regards to origin, if you are Italian-American or if you are German-American, it is key here. I mean, one fantastic example of this is Chris Capozzola's book on the topic of the home front in the United States. The Klan itself creates this America first, this 100% Americanism ideology. It's a very flexible ideology because the Klan is ultimately trying to suit the needs of the people it's trying to attract. So it incorporates contradictory ideas throughout its formation. I mean, you know, it is anti-Catholic, it is anti-Semitic, it is white supremacist, but at the same time, it has a lot of progressive ideas. I mean, for God's sake, the second imperial wizard, Hiram Wesley Evans, even advocates free American healthcare for all citizens in order to appeal to various different communities. So this idea of Americanism is just a useful cover for essentially whatever the hell the Klan is trying to sell in that particular moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the one thing before, I know Malcolm's got another question, the one thing I wanted to just, you know, stress to listeners as well is just how widespread the Klan becomes in some areas. You know, this is an organization that holds a huge parade down Washington, D.C., openly parades throughout areas in New York. You know, I think it was really big in Suffolk County, where like about 1 in 6 of the adult population is a member of the Klan. So this is not, for a brief while, it's, and we'll discuss its downfall in a minute or two, it's not a fringe organization. So Miguel, you...
We don't actually know how many Klansmen there are, because the Klan is fond of exaggerating how many there are, and their opponents of the Klan are also fond of exaggerating. But, you know, we're talking about somewhere in the region of 2 to 4 million American men, women, and children join the Klan, which, if you consider that the American population in the 1920s is about 100 million, is quite, quite significant. And in fact, the Klan is more popular outside of the Deep South, as you would call it, than it is anywhere else. There's more Klansmen in the city of Indianapolis than there is in the whole state of Mississippi. Indiana being one of the states where the Klan is, you know, something like a third to a half of all adult white males belong to that particular order.
So I've got a couple of questions. One is a very quick one for you, Miguel. The names of the officers of the Klan, dragons, wizards, all this, you know, they can... I mean, I used to play Dungeons & Dragons quite a lot. It sounds as if they're a bunch of basement-dwelling Dungeons & Dragons players. Just very briefly, are these just names just for kind of the impressive value of them? How did they come up with these names?
A lot of the names are taken directly from the Reconstruction Order, changed a little bit to suit the new group. A lot of the names are actually related to the alliteration KL. So you have a Kligrap, you have a Clexter, you have a Clarogo. All of these things are various officers within a clavern. But this is essentially what fraternities do during this particular period. It's not out of the ordinary. For instance, you have the Concatenated Order of Hoo-Hoo, which is based on the Lewis Carroll poem, The Hunting of the Snark, which President Warren Harding belongs to, by the way. In that particular order, you can become a Bojum, and you can become a Snark if you rise within the ranks. It's just part of the fun of fraternities.
Okay, so Morsi, I never knew that part of it. So, the Order of Hoo-Hoo, I need to bring that up in a lecture. Anyway, so we've talked about popular culture in the form of film, in the form of Birth of a Nation and Intolerance and films like that. Just thinking about other cultural forms and how writers and artists responded to racism in America and or associated themselves with the KKK's message. And I found myself particularly geekily interested in the views of Rhode Island's H.P. Lovecraft. He's a crucial figure in the development of modern horror and speculative fiction, a relatively obscure figure in his day, but was popularized much more widely after his death and continues to be a huge figure in speculative fiction circles. We expressed great admiration for the KKK, and his writings are really infused with racial fears and anxiety about miscegenation, about race, about all of these things. And at the same time as Lovecraft is writing, we also have the so-called Harlem Renaissance, this great flowering of African-American writing and poetry and art and all these kind of things. So I guess, Mike, in simple terms to both of you, my question is, how did producers of popular culture support and oppose the KKK's ideology?
I think with the Harlem Renaissance, I think it's essentially about challenging this stereotype. And I think, too, it's a reflection of the changes happening in America in terms of the great migration of African Americans northwards to cities, New York, Chicago, Detroit. And we have this term, the new Negro, that begins to be used, although that had started to be used actually much earlier, around the turn of the 20th century. Indeed, Washington uses that term to describe this kind of new generation of African Americans who are successful writers, businessmen, professionals. But in the Harlem Renaissance context, of course, it is African Americans who are determined to stand up and fight for their rights, and to be visible and to very publicly challenge some of these dominant images in popular culture. And you've got, of course, the famous Aaron Douglas paintings that express American history and African American history, that visually, if you like, show the legacy of slavery, the legacy of Reconstruction, and, you know, portraying this in a different kind of way. So we have that, and of course there's also photography, which I did mention earlier, which there are a number of African-American photographers who are trying to, again, present a different kind of image of African-Americans. And right at the end of Washington's life, there's a whole series of photos in 1915 that essentially follow him on the road and taking sort of candid shots of him, you know, talking to crowds, but also in his office, and he's behind a desk, and it's a very kind of well-appointed office. And it's, again, really showing, well, look, here is a black man in an office sitting down behind a desk. It's a very powerful image to challenge the kind of white stereotypes of African-Americans that simply could not kind of envision African-Americans doing anything like that. And so I suppose the point being is that much of what we talk about, I think, with, you know, the 20s kind of Harlem Renaissance, you know, its origins, if you like, emerge much earlier, and not just in, you know, northern cities. You know, this is something that's happening in the South as well, in sort of challenging again this sort of stereotyping.
More specifically, with regards to the Klan itself, the emergence of the Klan essentially allows popular culture writers and cartoonists of various sorts to talk about race more openly and the visions of America that exist at the time. So, for the opponents of the Klan, it gives them an opportunity to, sort of reveal the true nature of of the American order, of American white supremacy. You know, one great example of this is Langston Hughes' poem Ku Klux Klan, which is a very powerful, discussion of what the Klan actually is. It's a dehumanizing, brutal, white supremacist organization. But then there's a whole bunch of other ones that essentially, try to disassociate the first Klan, the Reconstruction Klan, and the second Klan, because they regard the Reconstruction Klan, and from what I've been told, H.P. Lovecraft viewed it this way, they view it as honorable and necessary for the dangers of Reconstruction, whereas the current Klan is a cash grab, which in some senses it definitely was, because, you know, you've got 2 to 4 million Americans joining your group, and you charge each one of them about $10 for a set of, you know, poorly made robes, there's going to be a lot of money involved. And a lot of people become very wealthy out of it. Even Thomas Dixon, the author of the Reconstruction trilogy, comes out and says this new plan is it's unnecessary and it's mostly about the money for Thomas Dixon.
Cool. Well, I mean, I could talk about this for hours, but we are fast running out of time, so I better move on to the last couple of questions. And so Miguel, you, as you said, you're just finishing off your book, and you're sort of talking about the importance of fraternalism and a fraternity to the KKK. So here's your soapbox to go for it. Unfortunately, it's a shaky soapbox that's going to collapse in about a couple of minutes. So if you could fit in what you want to chat about in that time, that'd be great. Thanks.
The Klan's fraternalism is very much at its core. The core of its being. Some of its most iconic ceremonies and symbols, the hoods, the burning of the cross, all these other sorts of elements, are fundamental to the formation. How do you get white strangers to bond together if not through this idealization of white supremacy and of white masculinity? So that is very much at its core. It's also a very useful protection, because fraternities are an intrinsic part of American life during this period, and if the Klan claims to be a fraternity, they place themselves alongside respectable groups that exist during this period, such as the Freemasons.
My God, that was far quicker than I thought.
I feel we should also kind of, it would be remiss not to conclude this section with what happens to the Klan. This iteration of the Klan, because it has, it's hard to feel sympathy. It goes through relatively tough times. So, I mean, again, that, your brevity was amazing there, Miguel. What happens to this iteration of the Klan?
So, the 1920s Klan really, it looks like it declines in 1925. Some historians have suggested it might be due to the declining importance of, you know, things that concerned white Americans before, such as potential immigration from the war-torn nations of Europe, the potential arrival of radicals from Hungary, Russia, Mexico, Ireland, all these places that are going through radical turbulence during this period. It also has to do with the fact that the Klan is, as I said, a money-making organization, and there's internal disputes about who gets to control things. There's also a number of different scandals, such as in Indiana, the case of Madge Oberholzer, where the former Grand Dragon D.C. Stevenson kidnaps, rapes, and essentially murders a particular woman, leads to an implosion. But from my perspective, I think one of the key things is that because the Klan is a fraternity, you know, during this period, fraternities aren't something that people commit themselves that much to. And in fact, most people who join the Klan are not as committed as we might imagine. They're not fanatical about their membership. So they just stop going. There's only so many times you can perform the ritual before you just get bored as hell, because it is not that entertaining. So 5 years in, people eventually get tired. We also have to take into account that about 1924, the Klan forms the Women of the Ku Klux Klan and the Junior Ku Klux Klan. And so it's not as fun to be part of a group where your wife might be involved, even though the Klan is pitched as a family group. The exclusivity of the Klan, this idealization of white masculinity, sort of loses its touch once the Klan is sort of open to pretty much anyone. They even form a group called the American Crusaders, with a K, of course, that is open to white Protestant men who were not born in the United States, so from the Nordic sort of countries and from Northwestern Europe.
Yeah, and then the final thing, I always like to cheer up my students when I'm teaching about the Great Depression by going, well, there was some benefits. People couldn't afford their KKK fees anymore. So,
so in order to conclude what's been a great discussion, I've found it so informative, as I do all these discussions we have for the podcast, bringing it up to date into 21st century America, you have read quite a few pieces of commentary about the contemporary environment of racism and racial discrimination in America as a new Jim Crow. Now, I mean, we all know that de facto segregation, racism, and all these things have never, ever gone away in the United States. First off, are there valid comparisons to be drawn between the Jim Crow era, the period we've been talking about, whether it's in terms of the racism or the responses to racism? Is it valid to draw comparisons between that period and the 21st century? And here's a fairly loaded question, just like Mark started with. Do you think that with the current administration, are things going to get worse before they get better? Who's going to go with that one first?
I'll go first.
Yay! Well done, Stephen.
I mean, there's always limits to any kind of comparison, as we all know. And whether things will get worse, again, that's hard to say. I mean, it's clearly, you know, the current administration is emblematic of a particular form of white nationalism. I mean, I think in some ways, maybe moving to what's going on in the South is one way of thinking about this kind of comparison. And, you know, it's been 5 years now that a Moral Monday movement's been happening in North Carolina. Reverend William Barber of North Carolina leading that movement against the policies of the Republican state government that are targeting African Americans in terms of limits to the right to vote, for example. And so there's a clear comparison there. And actually, I believe he's a book is coming out called The Third Reconstruction that we're actually in at the moment as a response to this, the second being, of course, the Civil Rights Movement. So in that sense, I think a comparison can be drawn. This term new Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander, her book, looking at the incarceration rates of African Americans, which, of course, is something that, you know, you can trace back decades, really, and, you know, the inherent racism there. So to some degree, yes, some comparisons, but I think that kind of climate, the intensity, I suppose, of that climate, and I suppose the lack of engagement on the part of white Americans in the North that was, I think, a feature of the first Jim Crow, clearly is not the same now. And obviously we live in a kind of, you know, the post-civil rights era moment as well. You know, there are kind of limits there. But I think certainly, if nothing else, I think what's happening today reinforces the essential continuity of many of these issues, you know, the inherent racism in so much of American society, the way that white supremacy changes over time to meet different, you know, to respond to a changing context. I think that in of itself is kind of, you know, demonstrates that there is some utility to drawing a comparison with earlier forms of white supremacy.
Just to add to that, I mean, I think the key aspect of that particular label is the new sort of element, the new Jim Crow. The mass incarceration of African American males, the, you know, the disparate sentences that are provided to black and white offenders, particularly when it relates to drug charges and things like that. There is certainly cause to refer to it as the new Jim Crow. But, you know, from a much broader sort of perspective, I think, you know, there are some troubling things on the horizon, in particular the invalidation of key portions of the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County v. Holder from 2013. That one is something that, you know, has only really sort of reached the mainstream press since the election of Trump because of the supposedly key role it played in that particular. But I think that one's going to be, fundamental. And I don't think it's going to be, improving anytime soon, particularly with the fact that the Supreme Court has now been filled with appointees from the more conservative side of things that are going to be pushing against various other things, such as perhaps affirmative action and programs such as that. But at the same time, I don't want to overemphasize the oppression. When it comes to African American history, there are these two dual forces of oppression and agency, and it's important not to overstate one over the other, because at the same time that the administration is doing all of those sort of things, you know, back in 2017 in December, we saw the incredible election of Doug Jones, which was primarily thanks to the votes of particularly African American citizens who went out and pushed for these particular sort of issues, and essentially managed to sort of counteract some of the elements that have been sort of invalidated as part of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, thank you very much. Gentlemen, somehow we've already done an hour and 10 minutes and only feels like half an hour, so that's a good sign to me that it was an enjoyable podcast. And we will be back probably, well, less than a month from now, because we're going to get back to our usual schedule of releasing at the end of each month rather than at the beginning, we promise, as long as Malcolm doesn't go off for a nice jaunt to the Presidential Library of Warren Harding, if he has one. But anyway...
It would be a return to normalcy.
Well, thanks again. Thanks, Miguel. Thanks, Stephen. And thanks, as always, Malcolm. And thank you, listeners. We shall see you again next month. See you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and goodbye.